This is Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. In the next half hour, we'll have more on our continuous coverage of the war in Colombia, with talk in the U.S. Congress of increasing U.S. military aid to Colombia to combat the drug war. We'll hear from the president of one of Colombia's leading human rights groups about what impact this aid has had on the civilian population in that country. Then we'll take a look at the status of women in the Caribbean. The Commission of the Status of Women met recently at the United Nations to follow up on the implementation of the Beijing platform. We'll hear from a representative on the commission from Trinidad. Coming up next on Our Americas. One of four Americans taken hostage by Colombian guerrillas escaped on April 2nd after 11 days in captivity in the mountains east of Bogotá, the capital. Military sources said 43-year-old Thomas Fiore fled the remote Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia rebel camp and walked more than 6 hours through the rugged region before, by chance, meeting a team of local television journalists. Fiore said he was treated well by the FARC rebels, and he told the RCN radio network that he escaped early in the morning when the rebels allowed him to go to the bathroom in nearby trees. The rebels had threatened to kill him and the three other U.S. hostages if they proved to be undercover U.S. intelligence agents. Family members have said all four hostages were bird watchers and denied that they were U.S. spies. The kidnapping took place about a week after FARC rebels put out a public warning against U.S. intelligence officials working in Colombia. According to their warning, those officials said to be working with the Colombian military in the war against drugs would be considered legitimate military targets because the Colombian military is actually using U.S. aid as a smokescreen for a counter-guerrilla offensive. The State Department, meanwhile, has denied being involved in a counterinsurgency war in Colombia. These developments were taking place as the Congress was considering boosting its counter-drug aid package to Colombia by upwards of $21 million for the next fiscal year. It has raised alarm bells among the Colombian and international human rights community. They argue this aid will only exacerbate an already dismal human rights situation, which has escalated out of control in the last 10 years. On April 1st, the Institute for Policy Studies, in conjunction with the Washington Office on Latin America and the Colombia Human Rights Committee, held a major conference in Washington, D.C. about Colombia. One of the speakers present was Gustavo Gallón, the executive director of the Colombian Commission of Jurists. He laid out the history of political violence, where over the last 12 years, an average of 10 people have been killed daily for political reasons in Colombia. He likened the current situation in his country to other countries and urged the U.S. and the international community to play a constructive role in building a lasting peace in Colombia. This is Gustavo Gallón.
It is like Greece or Brazil in the 60s and 70s, or like Argentina, Uruguay, and Chile in the 70s. And the early 80s, or like El Salvador or Guatemala for the last 30 years. Like those countries, Colombia is marked by major social differences, where some guerrilla groups were created in the 60s. They proclaimed to combat both social injustice and the political monopoly at the time made up of two main parties, the liberals and the conservatives. Some of the guerrilla groups made peace agreements with the government in the early 90s after the decline of that political monopoly and participated in drafting more democratic rules of power adopted in a new 1991 constitution. Other guerrilla groups continued active, perhaps convinced that political reform alone was not enough to warrant abandoning a struggle based on the ideal of transforming the whole society through the taking of power by arms. As in Greece, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, El Salvador, or Guatemala, the army in Colombia has been very involved in the practice of torture and other human rights violations. The majority of victims have not been soldiers or guerrillas, but the civil population. But in contrast to Greece and most Latin American countries, this tragedy continues to this day. Torture is no longer the main practice. Instead, it is murder or forced disappearance. The Colombian military didn't stage a coup d'etat like the Greek colonels or the officers of the Southern Corps or Guatemala. Rather, their direct participation in violations has gradually decreased, while the involvement of apparently civilian paramilitary groups has systematically increased over the last 5 years. These differences, unfortunately, make the Colombian situation more dramatic, difficult, and painful than the terrible situation suffered by other countries over the last 3 decades. The most infamous period for the practice of torture in Colombia was in the late 70s. Many people were arrested and tortured, especially after the guerrilla group M19 stole 5,000 weapons from the army January 1, 1979, through a tunnel. The Colombian military had learned to torture from their American instructors, as was later recognized in 1996 by the chief of the United States Southern Command when he asked for pardon before a meeting of military commanders of the Americas. These instructions were the same given to the military in Greece, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, El Salvador, and Guatemala, for instance. Many were used extensively in the War of Algiers. By the late 70s, when the dictatorships established in some of these countries were coming to an end, the Colombian military was well prepared to pass from amateur and localized torture, often suffered in the country's history, to professional torture, a systematic and massive practice aimed at obtaining information and generating terror. Torture proved to be useful for capturing some guerrilla leaders and members, but it didn't prove to be effective for winning the war. What's more, torture practice at that time resulted in serious disaffection on the part of large sectors of the society from the armed forces. This disaffection occurred even if other important sectors of society supported the practice of torture. Certainly, in public, people avoided stating what some said in private about the use of torture as the only means that could destroy the internal enemy. But it was quite common to see the most powerful newspapers denying the existence of torture. The military argued that denouncing torture was merely a guerrilla's tactic of war, while prosecutors linked to the army investigated claims of torture in order to absolve the perpetrators and indict the victims of torture as slanderers. Along with people who were tortured, I personally suffered this kind of harassment when I assisted them as their attorney. The violation caused by torture is not limited to physical or psychological mistreatment. It is complemented by the falsification of the truth and the persecution of people interested in this truth. Sometimes it seemed in the late 70s and the early 80s in Colombia that society was divided between those who believed that there was torture in the country and those who didn't believe it, who didn't want to believe it. It was necessary to attempt to use different legal procedures in order to obtain a formal declaration of the occurrences of torture. Today, nobody denies that the army tortured extensively in the early 80s. But the strong denial of its existence during those years allowed its practice against who knows how many people and avoided the punishment of the perpetrators. Nobody has been condemned for torture in Colombia, in contrast with Greece, Argentina, or Chile. One person is recorded as being tortured in Colombia each day on average. Less than 10% of these cases are denounced by the victims themselves. The rest, more than 90%, are persons found dead with signs of torture. That means that torture continues to be practiced in Colombia today. But the level of killings and forced displacements is so high that many of the victims might think that fortunately they lucky were to be alive, so it is better not to denounce the crime. Consequently, the real number of cases of torture in Colombia must be greater than what is known. However, it seems that there are fewer instances of torture than political murders and forced disappearances, which have become the preferred means of combating the internal enemy today. Nowadays, torture and arbitrary detention alone are seen as less useful techniques. Not only have techniques changed, so have the actors, apparently. 5 years ago, more than 50% of political killings were attributed to the armed forces, and less than 20% to paramilitary groups. Today, both continue to be denounced as the perpetrators of more than 70% of the political violence in Colombia. But the internal distribution of these actions has been inverted as between them. Today, more than 50% of political killings are attributed to paramilitary groups, and less than 20% to the armed forces. An optimistic reading of this reduction of cases attributed to the army could explain it as a result of improved respect for human rights by the soldiers. This is partially true. Certainly, in the 90s, there have been some soldiers really concerned about the need to respect human rights, probably due to the increasing national and international claims of human rights violations. A pessimistic reading of the mounting of cases attributed to paramilitary groups could explain it as a result of a new policy aimed at covering up violations committed by state agents. This explanation may also be partially true. There is no known plan by the army or the police to seriously combat the paramilitary groups. The government agents have been unable to capture the best known paramilitary leaders, and even active cooperation between paramilitary groups and members of the armed forces have been found in many cases. An alternative explanation for this phenomenon could be a combination of the optimistic and the pessimistic interpretation. Some members of the armed forces are trying to be more respectful of human rights, while others are trying to support covert actions. The big question is which of these two tendencies is going to prevail in the near future. The majority of Colombians who are not party to the conflict should be able to forcefully demand the substantial reduction and the elimination of all types of violations of human rights and humanitarian law. It is difficult to explain why this has not happened. Some people, both inside and outside the country, see the Colombian tragedy as a war of everybody against everybody else. Convinced that it is a confusing situation, these people remain static, perplexed, or demobilized. They don't realize that it is only a small number of warriors who are risking the extinction of Colombia. Our situation is certainly complex, but not confusing. The responsibilities of each violent actor can be identified and distinguished. The state, especially, should not be involved in violations, should be able to protect the population, and should actively punish abuses. Another cause of perplexity about the Colombian situation is the existence of links between human rights violations and drug trafficking. They certainly exist, but not to the point where one can identify the war on drugs with respect for human rights. Moreover, the war on drugs can be a very dangerous source of violations of human rights and humanitarian law. Massive and systematic violations existed in Colombia before there were successful Colombian drug traffickers. Many paramilitary groups are supported by drug traffickers, as Alejandro showed right now, who have become powerful landowners, but not only by them. Traditional landowners and members of the armed forces are also engaged in paramilitary activities. Some guerrilla groups benefit from extortion imposed on coca growers and traffickers, but it would be a grave simplification of reality to think that the anti-guerrilla phenomenon can be reduced to a drug business. Giving military aid to destroy coca crops, kill coca growers, and combat guerrilla groups considered supporters of the cocaine trade risk turning the southern half of the country into a field of war zone, increasing the possibility of Colombia becoming extinct. Colombia does not need any more violence to redress the human rights situation. Colombia needs the cooperation of the legitimate action of the international community, and the combination of this cooperation of the international community and the action of the domestic forces is the only way to overcome the present crisis. Thank you very much.
Gustavo Gallon is the executive director of the Colombian Commission of Jurists and is a fellow at Notre Dame University. He was speaking at a conference held in Washington, D.C. on April 1st, which was sponsored by the Institute for Policy Studies. In future programs, we'll be playing more highlights of that conference. And you're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. The Commission of the Status of Women held its annual meeting in New York in late March. This UN body is responsible for monitoring the implementation of the 12 critical areas of concern from the Beijing Platform of Action. This year, the Commission focused on four key areas: the human rights of women, the girl child, women in armed conflict, and violence against women. One of the women present at the conference was Asha Cambon of Trinidad and Tobago. Asha Cambon is a gender and development consultant and a member of the commission. She worked as a social development officer with responsibility for women and development at the Economic Council of Latin America and the Caribbean. Producer Patrika Dallas talked with Ms. Cambon during the commission's meeting in New York and first asked her about how the four main themes affected women in the Caribbean region.
Let's look at them, see if we can, one at a time. For instance, in the area of violence against women, the Caribbean has been, in fact, in the forefront. Women's organizations and governments have been in the forefront of, say, teaching legal literacy to women to ensure that they understand their rights. A number of laws have been passed in the region, domestic violence bills, bills that deal with, for instance, how you treat cases of sexual abuse against children, whether or not those should be heard in camera or whether they should be heard in open court, bills that offer protection to women that they can, for instance, file injunctions against abusive partners and so on, and have them stand out of the home. For instance, in the past, in most of the laws, the legislation in the region, if a father were accused, say, for instance, of incest or abuse against a child, the child would be removed from the household, which would be a double burden on the child. But now, with the new legislation and so on, the parent would have to leave the household, and the child would be able to stay in the comfort and security of its own home. So I think a lot of legislation has been passed, and there's a lot of work being done, for instance, on shelters for battered women. I mean, probably many of the islands now, islands of the English-speaking Caribbean, have shelters for battered women, have more advanced homes for children who have been victims of abuse.
In terms of women in armed conflict, what does that have to do with CARICOM countries, one might add?
Yes. I remember when we were preparing for the Beijing conference, the issue came up, do we really have a lot to say about this question of armed conflict, and are we maybe engaging in something that has nothing to do with us? But in fact, when we looked at the question of women in armed conflict, it was our sisters from Haiti who brought that issue right up to the table for us. And you know, Haiti is now acquiring full status with CARICOM, so it becomes a CARICOM country. But, for instance, when they broadened the concept of armed conflict, was it just conflict between nations, or could it be conflict within a nation? And were women at risk, and were children at risk, when there was conflict within nations? And, in fact, a lot of the data showed us that, in fact, they were at risk. So that, for instance, in Haiti, remember, you had a lot of military-related rapes of women and children, and someone had to bring those people to justice, so that the issue and the kinds of actions that were recommended for governments addressed the situation in Haiti and, say, the Dominican Republic and other countries in the region.
And then the rights of the girl child was one of the areas of concern. What about the role of young people within the society?
The rights of the girl child, let me start by saying that for the Caribbean, that was a very critical area, because you know in the region we have a propensity to early childbearing and high fertility rates among the young. And of course that stymies the whole possibilities of the chances that people and choices that young women are able to make in terms of their further education and so on. And so that becomes a very significant issue. However, I think the region has not yet matured. Although we've all signed the Convention on the Rights of the Child and we're all signatories to that convention, we've not yet matured in terms of understanding that, in fact, children have voices to be heard. You know our old saying at home, you know, a child is to be seen and not heard. We haven't seemed to have gotten rid of that yet and understood that children have voices, they have rights, they have to be allowed to speak on their own behalf, and so on. And I think it is a sore point in the relationship between the generations in the region.
What about the concept of women's rights as human rights? To what extent is that informing the work that's being done?
I would think more and more there's a greater acceptance. We're lucky because we come from societies where people have struggled for their rights. And everyone has a deep understanding of the respect for people's human rights, that people have rights and that they will struggle for those rights. The other side of the coin, however, is that despite the fact that that's the kind of history that the Caribbean has come up from, and when I say that, I mean struggle from since the emancipation, struggle for emancipation, struggle in the Butlerite era for labor union rights and so on, struggle for independence, it is a society that knows about struggle. What we are facing now, however, is a rising fundamentalism. And that's a very frightening phenomena. It's not something we are accustomed to. But there's a rising religious fundamentalism. And I see it across the board, whether it comes from the Christian fundamentalist, the Hindu fundamentalist, the Islamic fundamentalist. There is a rising fundamentalism that's encroaching somewhat on what rights women have and what rights other people have.
Okay, the commission ended its session a week ago, last Friday.
Yes.
And has adopted a number of draft resolution and such. Are you pleased with this?
I'm pleased with a number of them that came out. I'm more unhappy with what didn't happen, in the sense that the lack of the conclusion around the question of the optional protocol. I'm sorry for that, because the optional protocol would have allowed women's organizations to be able to bring cases to the CSW and to the CEDAW, to the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against
One example is that, like in the case of Haiti.
Okay, how will that impact on, say, for instance, Haiti or any Caribbean country, for instance? If the optional protocol is not passed, as it stands now, only states' parties can bring complaints to the commission. It means that women who've been abused, who suffered abuse, cannot either as individuals or as a group of individuals bring those complaints. They have to wait until their state brings it. Whereas if we can agree on an optional protocol that allows for individuals, either individuals on their own or people on behalf of individuals. Because let me explain this. One of the problems in the region, as you know, the Caribbean islands are very small islands. And one has to be able to protect the identity of women who've been abused, otherwise they're not going to come forward. And the value of having an optional protocol that allows people to be able to bring the cases of others on their, rather than allow them to come on their own behalf, is very important to small territories where everyone knows everyone and people may be victimized or may feel stigmatized if they bring a case before an international body such as the Commission. I'm pleased with the work that came out on the, say for instance, the debate. I'm pleased with the heightening of awareness around the questions of globalization. There's a lot of discussion within the context of violence against women on the question of globalization, and I think that was very important because we are now in an era where the free market economy, where privatization, where the WTO, and preferential agreements are being completely eliminated, preferential trade agreements, and that's going to impact seriously on our small island territories, such as the banana-producing islands, and a lot of women are small farmers. And therefore, we have to take into consideration these international agreements and how they're going to impact on the livelihoods and the possibilities of choices of future generations.
There was one problem, though, I noticed, that although the numbers increased in terms of women coming to the conference, representatives from non-governmental organizations, etc., the turnout for the Caribbean region was extremely low. What is the cause of this?
Yes, I was very disappointed myself that both at the level of governments and non-governmental organizations, there was a very low turnout. It could be the financial crisis in the region. That may be one of the reasons, because I don't think it's a lack of interest on the region on the part of these, in relation to these issues, because the region has been in the forefront of, for instance, dealing with economic development issues, has been in the front of the legal frameworks for violence against women, and has really been in the forefront on the rights of the child and the young girl, the girl child. So I would think that probably it has to do with financial crisis. It has to do with the threats, as we mentioned, globalization and the whole. A lot of people are just preoccupied now with salvaging their husbanding, as they say, their meager resources, because these things can be taken away from them in this new era of trade agreements and these new era of multilateral investments and so on.
So then, how does the Caribbean get their voices heard?
Really, the governments have to make the sacrifice, and the NGOs have to receive support from the international donor community so that, in fact, they can have representation at those meetings. To me, it was very clear that the absence of Caribbean NGOs left the meeting pretty Eurocentric in terms of the concerns of the northern countries and the Eurocentric countries. European countries became the dominant concerns of the meeting, because although the African sisters had a strong presence, but there was a not adequate presence from, say, the Latin American and Caribbean sector to give them the kind of support they need to make the position of the southern countries known and felt at a meeting such as that.
Asha Kambon is a gender and development consultant and a member of the Commission on the Status of Women. She was speaking with producer Patrika Dallas. And that's about all the time we have on today's program. How Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI Pacifica Radio in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. It is funded in part by a grant from the Funding Exchange and the New York State Council on the Arts, and is distributed by Pacifica National Programming. Associate producers are Sarah Gill, Walter Krakmal, Amy Standen, and Laura Tarantini, with production assistance by Miguel Gonzalez and Vicky Hippel. Special thanks to Winifred Tate, Jeremy Scahill, and Patrika Dallas. If you have any questions or comments, you can send us an email at mmcompa@igc.org. For Our Americas, I'm Mario Murillo. Thanks for listening, and stay strong.